Ballarat Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your home.
Live from the Forbidden Book Group studio in Doppeltown, USA, it's Necronomipod with your hosts, Mike Stoffel and Mike Moncada. Episode 5, Jack Williamson's Darker Than You Think. The story of a man who becomes a wolf and the woman who loves it. And now, Necronomipod.
Those found without specific military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Conrad Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways.
Okay, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. To our latest episode of Necronomipod.
Episode five.
Wow, we're up to five.
Which we've already...
Good for us.
Hopefully our intro will say...
Yes. Yeah, we'll have to...
Yeah, I know. We stuck with it.
Yeah, who knew? I'm still having fun.
I'm still amazed that we even got it going.
Mike and I have lots and lots of ideas of things, of little projects to do, and most of them fade with the
blink of an eye.
The blink of an eye with the fading of the beer buzz, but this one has stuck because
we're narcissists.
Because we're narcissists, we really love to hear the sounds of our own voices, and we think we're funny. I'm funnier than he is.
I'm gonna have to kick your ass again. See, those video games are violent.
They're very violent.
So today
we are talking about, as promised, Jack Williamson's classic novel, Darker Than You Think.
Yep. And before we do that, though, I have to make a little pledge.
Okay.
Because after listening to our last podcast...
Okay, you can't see this, listeners, but right now he has his hands up in the air with three fingers raised, like the good boy scout that he is.
And I was.
So was I.
And I'm swearing on Jack Williamson's novel.
On Jack Williamson's novel. So what is your pledge?
Pledge number one is I promise I will not pound the table ever again.
I wasn't going to say anything, but it was not me.
It was so annoying.
The table last time.
Pledge number two, I promise not to repeat myself.
I'm sorry.
Over and over again.
What was that? Can you tell me that one more time? Oh, God.
Pledge number three, I promise not to clink my glass. Or open bottles or anything.
Okay, well, I'll make a pledge to it. I will pledge to be audible. I think that's something I should try to do, is I will try to endeavor to be audible.
Yeah, we will correct our audio our novice efforts. We'll become more professional.
Our non-know-it-allness when it comes to this stuff. We're going to get ourselves like a sexy new microphone. We're just shopping for new
microphones. We're dreaming.
Oh, the dreaming.
Okay.
So Jack Williamson's Darker Than You Think.
Yeah.
So we just sort of picked this book out of the air. I suggested it, Mike agreed, and then we read it. It was kind of familiar to me.
It was. I would have said if it wasn't the first one it was written, I would have said it was pretty derivative.
But it's not. It's actually foundational.
It is. Yeah, it's foundational.
It's foundational.
It's like a Playtex girdle. It's that foundational.
It's foundational.
Like a whalebone bone corset.
Like a whalebone corset. Stabbing you just under there.
Right, but you go, oh, this was an episode of Night Stalker, or oh, this was this was in The X-Files,
I knew very little about this book. This book makes a couple of lists of, like, you know, big important horror novels, and a lot of the books that we've been we've been reading. I mean, several of them, the Fritz Leiber books, I sort of suggested because they made, you know, like the horror, top 100 best horror books list, or another 100 horror books list.
And we are committed to reading older, foundational.
Yeah, exactly.
Seminal.
seminal. But this book, this book was put up as sort of a werewolf novel. And it is.
Sort of. In the broadest sense of the word, yes. Wolf, meaning beast.
Like, yes.
It's a werebeast.
It's a lycanthropy novel.
Lycanthropy.
Lycanthropy being the...
I took antibiotics for that once.
I did too. You know, I still get flare-ups every once in a while, you know, so I can't go on dates.
It's a good thing you're married.
It's a good thing I'm married. All right.
That was the one thing I was really looking for, a werewolf novel, and I felt disappointed.
And after this, there are, I mean,
wolves show up.
I can name werewolf novels. Mm-hmm. I can't think of like really, really. Well, I can think of a couple of really like big deal werewolf novels. Stephen King took a turn writing a werewolf novel called Cycle of the Werewolf, which I've never read. It's very short. Was it Whitley Strieber? Did he write the Wolfen?
Did he write Wolfen?
Yeah, before his abduction experience.
Abduction, Wolfen, yeah.
There's others, you know, horror novelists these days generally try, you know, seem to me to eventually get around to trying their hands at the werewolf novel.
I wonder why it's so hard to write.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe they're just not. I mean, when you think of horror novels now that sell, there was the big vampire craze.
Yeah, people love the vampire.
Yeah, but when you talk in horror fandom now, people are getting kind of sick of it. You know, people run down Anne Rice. We run down Anne Rice. Mm-hmm. I read exactly one novel of hers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, those kind of vampire novels aren't really particularly interesting.
Have you ever had Anne Rice pilaf?
No.
We'll have that in our next podcast. We'll have
Anne Rice pilaf at our next podcast. Well,
Anne Rice pudding. Anne Rice aroni.
Anne Rice aroni in San Francisco / New Orleans treat.
Yeah, I think the vampires have been played out.
They've been kind of played out. I mean, people are trying to do new things with him, trying to revitalize the genre,
the vampire coolie. You can tell I haven't eaten that much because I'm talking about food.
Yeah, he's very hungry.
Like the wolf.
Hungry like a wolf. Like the loup-garou.
Right, so maybe the werewolf novel will make a resurgence.
Yeah, I mean people try it, and there are werewolf. There are like a friend of ours, Eric, one of his coworkers and really good friends is just a werewolf fanatic. He knows everything about it. He should be sitting here, and if I knew his name, we'll interview him for a
5.5 episode.
Yeah, there you go, a follow up episode. But I can't think of, off the top of my head, a lot of werewolf novels that come after this, and I can't think of any that come before this.
Unless you consider, in the broadest sense of the word, Robert Louis Stevenson's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes.
That is a fair, I think that is a close.
It's a shape-shifting.
And if you think about it, and even they mention this in the books, I think the Greek myths...
Mm-hmm.
Loki. I mean, so the myths had shaped.
Oh yeah, there's tons of myths. I mean, the werewolf legend. I mean, in Darker Than You Think itself, they spend a lot of time talking about using mythology as scientific evidence for the existence of lycanthropy. We may not talk about this right now, but I do want to talk about it before we shut down. I want to talk about this as a horror novel written by a science fiction writer, because it very much is. I don't know. Well, actually, I don't know. We can talk about that right now if you'd like.
Well, why don't you talk a little bit more about Jack Williamson?
Yes, let's back up. We'll talk a little bit more about Jack Williamson.
We'll have to put a backup noise in there.
Okay. Jack Williamson. Jack Williamson is another grandmaster of science fiction writing, just like Fritz Leiber, who we spoke about in a number of earlier podcasts.
British?
Jack Williamson was not. He's from Arizona.
Are you sure?
I am quite certain.
All right.
Yeah.
Well-known drunk?
No. Well, it's possible, actually. Jack Williamson was a science fiction writer. He is probably has the distinction of being of having the longest career of any science fiction writer. He first published in one of the pulps. I don't think it was Weird Tales, but it may have been. Or I think it was like, actually, no, it was Amazing Stories. Mm. Amazing Stories, which was the great old science fiction magazine run by John W. Campbell Jr.
I thought that was a Spielberg,
Spielberg
TV show.
Spielberg named his TV show after this magazine. Back in 1928, he published that story. And Jack Williamson continued to publish regularly through the rest of his life, and his life was long. He died, I believe, at the age of 98 last November, in November 2006, having published just the year before his last novel.
Which was called?
I don't remember. Oh. But it was a science fiction novel. And he wrote science fiction novels for the most part, and lots of short stories. The first story was called The Metal Man, which is a really great, or something like that. Like it was about a robot or a metal guy or something like that, which is just classic pulp science fiction stuff. And actually classic Japanese anime as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Only they call them mechs. Mechas.
Mecha high, mecha chiny high.
Mecha high. But this book is comes early on, but you know he was 40 years old when he published this novel already in 1948.
Was it one of his first?
No. He published a number of other book novels. Probably his most famous novel is an expansion of his most famous short story, which is probably one of the top two or three science fiction short stories ever written, called With Folded Hands, which is about the dangers of letting machines do everything for you. And in that story, it's about creating a race of robots that are completely devoted to serving humanity, and so much so that it becomes oppressive. He was the guy that thought that up.
Not Ray Bradbury.
Not Ray Bradbury. But he expanded it into a novel called The Humanoids, which is one of the great, great science fiction novels, published in late 40s, early 50s, I think, about these robots escaping their planet and like going across the galaxy, one planet after another, much like the Borg, and assimilating them through simply serving. They're
serving them to death.
Serving them to death. Yeah, it's actually a quite interesting little story.
Death by Hazel.
Death by Hazel.
Hazel. No, who's the robot on the Jetson? Rosie.
Rosie.
They never trusted those beady little eyes.
Beady little eyes. The little metallic brand. Jack Williamson, however, I was looking at an interview that he conducted, that he gave in 2003. He's 95 years old. He was still working on it. He's getting ready yet another novel to publish. And he was asked by this interviewer, what his favorite novel that he published was. And this is it.
Get Out.
This is his favorite novel.
You gotta wonder why.
Well, he explains why.
Is it the saucy cover of the book?
Well, yeah, it is a rather saucy cover. I think we'll be using my cover.
Yeah, my book cover is not saucy.
It just has
saucy.
A wolf. But
a
mine,
big pink moon.
But mine has a foxy, rather lupine redhead astride a...
A griffin-like creature.
A saber-toothed tiger with a big
snaky
tail. Silhouetting the moon.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed. And he was asked why this was his favorite book. And he says, "Well, when I was writing that book, I was in analysis."
Comes through clear, loud and clear,
loud and clear. And he said he put a lot of his insights into his own personal psychology in there, which I found kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And also weirdly parallel to Fritz Leiber's work in Afterlife. And both of
them. Was he in Freudian analysis or Jungian analysis?
This guy was in Freudian analysis, that is for sure.
Well, but you know what? With all his hearkening to the gods and myths and stuff, that feels very Jungian.
Oh, it is very Jungian, but it's Jung did that sort of thing, but it seems to me it's more Freudian because it all points to this unbridled, unconscious, dark side, which is, that's just Freud.
That's Jung, man. Well, the shadow. That is the shadow. And Jung, and Freud did not have a shadow.
That's right. Well, Jung would say that that his psychology encompasses Freud's, like Islam encompasses Christianity, encompasses Judaism.
It is, yes, it is, yeah. Like our
frontal lobes. That was esoteric, wasn't it?
Like our frontal lobes encompass our reptilian brain, our amygdala, and our
yes, yes. So I don't know. So
I just wanted to mention that he is credited with inventing the terms.
Oh right, he is
genetic engineering, which is a lot of which is in this book, really.
Yeah,
and terraforming, which is not in this book.
Yeah, terraforming is actually, and that stands up. He more or less invented the term terraforming. He, for a long time, he said he claimed that he invented the concept of genetic engineering. But it turns out that in the same interview that I was reading, he says that actually a scientist had actually fronted the concept in a scientific paper. The term and the concept. 2 years before he came up with it. And so he says, you know, it's not me, but I did popularize it. In this book, Williamson comes up with a number of memes. How do you like that for a segue? Genes to memes. Ideas that self-replicate. The idea he actually plugs into a couple of memes. I'll say that. And we'll just talk about some of the parallels and the sources of this book if you want. I see.
This is Fritz Leiber written. Did Conjurwife come before this? Or were they?
Well, it's hard to say. Conjurwife was published in 1948 as well.
Did they know each other?
They had to have known each other because they're working the same markets. And there's not a lot of working science fiction writers back then who were getting published. And Fritz Leiber and Jack Williamson were almost exactly the same age, and
it is.
And they're working. I mean, they're writing for the same magazines. Jack Williamson was more of a hard science fiction writer. Didn't write a lot of fantasy. He wrote space opera. Fritz Leiber wrote space opera, but he wrote fantasy. He wrote horror. He just jumped genres wherever you get a sale. But Jack Williamson,
he's a literary whore.
Yeah. Well, Jack Williamson actually was a PhD. He was a professor. He's a very famous science fiction writer. He's not Isaac Asimov. He's not Ray Bradbury. But he's the next tier down.
Who knew?
Yeah, he's the next tier down. So, and he's a good writer. Yeah, and he taught writing for many years. He retired from his professorship in the 70s and just kept right on writing. There's one little anecdote in an obituary of his that I read about how self-effacing he was. He, grandmaster, still writing stories. Instead of having them agented, giving it to his agent and having the agent shop it around.
What do you write? Put it in a manila envelope and mail it?
Sent it in a manila envelope and sent it to an editor. It came in, it's called sending it over the transom, getting it over the transom. So this editor, who was, it was for a major magazine, tells a story about, I opened this envelope and it's from Jack freaking Williamson. He's sending me a manuscript over the transom. Yes,
please do.
Yes, I'll publish it. So he published it. In fact, a couple years before he died, he won a Hugo Award for best novella, which is really something. And it warmed his aging heart. I mean, he's in his
90s. Maybe that's what killed him.
Could have been. The excitement could have
the
been.
Warmth. Of course, it's
too
curious.
Much warmth in my heart. So to this book. Let's get into this
book. Yes, this book.
What do you want to say about this book?
I don't know what to say. I have to say I was extremely underwhelmed by it.
I was not extremely underwhelmed by it, but I was expecting the build up saying was that it was this whole.
Yeah, you did build. You built it up.
It wasn't me.
It was you. You had nothing but lauds and accolades.
I sing the hosannas of things I've never read all the time. I'm
starting to learn.
You're onto my little game. Hey, it got me through graduate school.
Yes, I picked it up. I picked up. First, I was excited because the book only cost me $1. And then I was.
$1? This stupid thing cost me $6.
I know.
Well, I had to shipping.
$1. I thought.
Let me see your copy here. It's a fantasy masterwork.
Yes.
See, it's building a number 38. It's not me.
Actually, I would recommend this fantasy masterwork because I went on their website and they are kind of committed to.
Oh yeah, there's a number
bringing back doing what we're doing, but more.
Yeah, bringing back
those masterworks.
Masterworks, classic past masters, past classics.
Bastards.
Classics.
Past.
Classics. So, but this book, Jack Williamson. I'm just going to jump into this right now.
Jump.
Here I go. Jack Williamson thinks, as a science fiction writer, about superstition and the supernatural. Mm-hmm. And he tries to explain it all.
Kind of like the preternatural.
Yeah. He brings in gene genetic theory. He brings in
kind of evolution.
Definitely brings in evolution. Competition of species. He talks about, all those terms he's talking about, the various waves of ice during the Pleistocene era, like the Mousterian age and all this kind of stuff. Those are all real.
Yeah,
those are all real. I mean, people don't really call them those ages that anymore. But at the time that he's writing and obviously like reading books about this stuff, right. That is cutting edge science, cutting edge Stone Age anthropology. And
which we, in a strange way, made it believable.
That's the trick. It's that science fiction writer's trick. You go, I can see where that would happen. They don't have to understand the explanation. You just have to put a place of something in that place where an explanation goes. It's sci-fi physics. I mean, it's Star Trek physics.
But you know what? You can put all the science. You can put it, the fancy dresses, fancy party dresses, science, anything you want. It still came down to. All evil comes through women.
Well, it comes through bad. It comes through competitive genes, through recessive genes.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering if this was around the same time the Bad Seed was written.
Possibly. You have to speak about that. I've never seen the Bad
Seed. The Bad Seed. It's that same thing. Is that there's that evil is basically genetic,
mm-hmm.
and that there are some people who are bad seeds.
Yeah,
and that it's part of their makeup. It's just part of fiber of their being.
I thought that this book did a pretty good job of that. From the point of view of the supposedly bad guys in this, they're not. You get the benefit of the doubt all the time, all the way through this book. You are not. He's very carefully keeping your sympathy away from the regular humans, the ones who are dying, because you're only in. Will Barbie's the narrator,
the main character's the protagonist.
Brain. You find out what's going on at the end, which is specifically that he is.
Well, you find out what's going on, but one eighth through the book, what's going to happen?
What did you know one eighth through the book?
I knew that he was the child of night. I knew it.
Did you really?
I had the asylum. I just kept waiting.
The asylum doc, Dr. Glenn.
I was reading it going, okay, when are they going to finally find out that he's the child of the night?
Yeah.
I knew she was a witch. I knew.
So that meme right there is called the Oedipus story. He's trying to find a child of the night. Who's the child of the night? It's
your child of the night.
I'm the problem I'm trying to solve. Which is really what psychoanalysis is.
It's really narcissist.
It's also what psychoanalysis is. You're the problem that you're trying to solve.
Yeah. Well, you're the thing that you're afraid of, which is really Jungian. You are the shadow.
You are the shadow.
Yeah. Your worst thing is the shadow. The worst thing is you.
Yeah, I wonder if this. I wonder if this podcast of ours is going to cause people to read more horror or more
or less
unreadable
or watch more TV.
Or I think it's going to cause them to watch more TV.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Or to read more unreadable Carl Jung. In college, I made a.
Carl Jung has grand ideas, but his writing style is very circular. And,
yeah, it's no style at all.
Yeah,
no, it's just. Well, it's
you know, it is what it is.
He took his drugs and
he has big ideas. Scribbling. So.
Yeah, big ideas and funny looking glasses and a magisterial mustache. Are we avoiding talking about this book again?
I don't know. God, why am I avoiding talking about this book? Because I was so I was underwhelmed by it. I thought the problem I had with the book was this. And it's the problem I have. Maybe it's with the problem I have with books written at this time is that everything is handed to you.
What did you
just do? Oh my God, I just pounded it on the table.
What did you just do?
Oh no.
Son of a bitch. What did you... Oh, you're doing that too? God damn it.
It's just handed to you. It's like those little, again, those little lectures of information.
Yes.
So there's not as much discovery as there's much somebody's going to tell you. It's like it's like the parlor room mystery where the detective comes in and tells the whole story and then weaves it all together.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah.
You know, then you have your...
And you don't find out, you know, and he says, you know, before I tell you who the murderer is, I'm going to tell you blah, 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 blah.
Right,
that scene, I'm sorry, that scene is at the very beginning of the book.
Pretty much.
And then, so the rest of the book, so the beginning of the book is the scene, first of all, he meets the fetching white wolf girl.
April Bell.
Bing!
and her cat... Fuzzy or Fifi,
God, that poor cat. Did you have some respect for the book's cojones to have the nerve to kill a kitten in the second chapter?
Yes.
See, now that's I had to give some props for that.
You did have to. It was very contemporary.
It's very contemporary.
Disdain of kittens.
Yeah, not everybody will. Not every writer in the 40s would kill a kitten in the second chapter. But it's going back to the I've gathered you all here because I've solved the mystery. Mm-hmm. That's how the book starts with the professor debarking the plane. He's solved his mystery, and then his lifelong research is I've come to an end. It's right
to
here
warn
in this box.
Humanity.
Yeah, to warn humanity that there's a competing
species.
Race, yeah, competing species, and then the rest of the book is basically. After his death, trying to find out what he was about to say. So it's just a long, drawn-out unveiling scene. It's a mystery.
Basically.
Yeah.
And then April sort of teaches... For one thing, it just bugged me. He goes... So the main character, Barbie, William...
Will Barbie,
finds the dead kitten.
Yes.
And the professor has died of an asthma attack.
Apparently, he was allergic to cats.
Magical, mystical, dancing cats. And apparently dead kittens are much more, are higher degree of allergens than living kittens.
They must kick out that enzyme like you wouldn't believe. They must, like blowing on a dandelion.
So he figures, he sees the cat and he figures, April's a witch. I mean, he basically sort of puts it together, bing, like within a page.
Yeah, which is probably why you saw the ending coming, because... His reaction to her was
pheromonal.
Was pheromonal. Yeah, it was his. There were things going on that he wasn't aware of.
So he's like, you know, tell me about yourself. They go out to dinner. Yeah. Tell me about yourself. Oh, I really can't. I'm a witch. And my father tried to kill me. And then they drink 38 daiquiris.
I know.
Speaking of daiquiris,
shall we give them?
It's cocktail time.
All right, what's the cocktail this week?
Tell us, Mike.
Well, we were thinking about this very hard. I usually try to, when I think of a cocktail for this cast, I search for inspiration within the book, specifically what they're drinking.
Yeah, I never knew that.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
There it is.
That's fascinating.
Fascinating. So in this book, they drink exactly two things. Will Barbie drinks whiskey. Lots and lots of whiskey.
Yeah, he's a drunk.
He is a drunk. He's an admitted drunk.
He's a celebrated drunk.
A celebrated drunk. A tippler, if you will. A jolly toper. Apparently, April Brell loves the daiquiri because on their one date, in human form.
Yeah. What was the name of the restaurant?
I don't remember.
Trojan Way or something?
Oh, Trojan Arms was her apartment.
Trojan Arms was her apartment.
It was her apartment building.
Go on. Go talk and I'll find the name.
So they go to this restaurant for dinner and dancing.
Mm-hmm. Which he can't afford.
Which he can't afford, yeah. And she's running up quite a bill. And they order, I don't know, I counted six daiquiris each. That's a lot. So I think...
That's a lot.
That's a lot of daiquiris.
Especially the way they made them back then.
Yeah.
With that bootleg gin.
This is after.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the name of the restaurant was Knob Hill.
Knob Hill. Yes. Knob Hill.
They pack away the daiquiris.
Oh, my God.
I think there was some champagne in there, too.
Yeah, I think there was some champagne in there as well. So, yeah, they're getting lit like a street lamp.
So tell us about the daiquiri that we'll be drinking.
So
that we are drinking.
So we came up collaboratively came up with a drink, a daiquiri. We're calling it the White Wolf Daiquiri. Mike here wanted to call it the White Bitch Daiquiri because that is what Will Barbie in the book refers to April Bell in her wolf form as about 90% of the time,
yes,
as the white bitch.
Bitch.
Significant? Probably not. The White Wolf Daiquiri.
A.K.A.
the White Bitch Daiquiri.
The Bloody Bitch.
Is, what did we say it was again? Oh, okay, I remember.
We'll taste it and then you'll know.
Okay, here it is. The White Wolf Daiquiri is, you take light rum. I would say,
or like what I like to call white rum.
Yeah, white rum. White rum. Well, for this drink, we'll call it white rum.
White rum.
You take two parts of white rum. You take one part organic, and I say organic because that's the way you can get the this juice as an unsweetened version. Organic pineapple coconut juice. You can get that. Pretty much, I've seen in most stores now that, you know, have more than three aisles. A teaspoon of powdered sugar. Put it in a cocktail shaker with some ice. Shake it up. Strain it into cocktail glasses. And enjoy Howling at the Moon.
Woof, woof, woof. Wow, wow, wow.
Wow, wow.
And so, it's delicious.
It's pretty delicious. It would be, without that sugar, it would be a little tart.
It's transformative.
It's transformative. It's chock full of lycanthropic goodness.
Yeah, and you might want to garnish it with some wolfbane. If you can't find that, then some
mint. Maybe some mint.
Some catnip.
Catnip. Basil.
Okay.
Very good. So there it is.
Enjoy.
Cocktail of the week. The White Wolf Daiquiri.
A.K.A.
I'm not AKAing it.
Okay.
So, back to the book. What else do we want to talk about this book? So, this book is chock full of mid-20th century, I'm going to see my analyst at $40 an hour.
Pretty damn cheap, too.
$40 an hour back then? How much is an analyst now?
Well, it depends.
If you go to a full-fledged Freudian.
Actually, I was, when I read...
Triple F.
Actually, when I read that, I thought, Jesus Christ! There has not been much of a... because therapists... What are they? We get reimbursed like $80.
Yeah.
So not much of an increase since 1940.
No. Yeah.
Analysts.
$40 back then. Let's see. A loaf of bread back then was probably a nickel.
A quarter. No.
No, it was probably a nickel.
So you could have bought a lot of bread.
We'll say 10 cents.
A lot of dough.
You can get a loaf of bread now for a buck and a half.
So, right? Analysts probably, I think probably a good analyst could charge $300 an hour.
Now, yes.
And I think that the going rate, like the average rate, would be about 120.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And this is a full.
But remember, in analysis, you go four times a week.
Four times a week for years.
For a long time.
For a long time, as they slowly.
In true analysis, in its purest form.
Yes, as they slowly invite you to unpack your psyche, because they don't do it for you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You do not have a butler to help
you.
A man servant.
Your psychological valet.
Valet.
So
really, this man. So I mean, in one respect, it's his journey. Well, wait, let's back up. What?
Boop, 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 boop. And we're back.
And we're back. So he has to. Oh, I forgot what I was going to talk about.
So this guy.
I had a brilliant point.
It'll come back
from like
to you.
5 points ago.
It'll come back to you.
Okay.
This book is loaded with Jack Williamson's. He's thinking obviously very deeply about the makeup of the human, psyche, and he's buying the whole Freudian thing. He lived long enough to see Freud completely. I would say completely discredited.
They're sort of on an upswing with him. Mildly. Yeah. But he's
moved from science, because back then he was science, and now he's literature. And literature is not scientific.
Well, but strangely, they are proving some of his observations through science,
Well,
I mean, as far as, he didn't have the equipment and the materials and things to understand the brain the way we do now, but
yeah.
they're seeing that some of what his insights, fit sort of the biology of things.
Interesting. Yeah. But his main theories, the stages, any scientific reasoning for that, are there?
You mean like the latency stage?
Yeah, latency or anal, oral.
They don't really talk about, anal. I mean, I think analysts, I mean, there are still young Freudian analysts.
Yes.
And they're much...
Yeah, actually,
they're still much more in vogue out east, and still and never really lost their status in a way out east.
Yeah,
I know here in Doppeltown there's a big resurgence of Freudian, of analytical study and analytical therapy.
There's the Jung Institute right over.
They're not analysts.
They're just a bunch of mandala makers.
I mean, they wouldn't come. I mean, they would. It is analysis, but it isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't considered Freudian analysis,
no.
Of course. I mean, Jung never was as popular as Freud was. I mean,
no, Freud wasn't as useful.
But yeah. So.
But
yeah.
But
so.
But this book is coming out of.
This was the heyday.
Out of the heyday of depth psychology, led by Freud, followed closely by Adler and. Otto Rank and Jung and all those, and even their benign American friend Erik Erikson, who went five stages wasn't enough, made it like eight, nine.
Right. So all stages of development.
Yeah, all kinds of developmental stages and so he's in analysis. This character. The course of this book is a course of analysis.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah,
he has no. He's clearly messed up. He's got a nasty drinking problem, and he knows it.
Well,
he's admitted. I mean, the beginning. One of the first things he says. He admits he has a problem.
Right.
And soon that he's powerless to help it himself, and so he turns himself over to. The foxy redhead of the white fur.
Well, there's also that idea that everybody else knows what's going on with him, but knows his true nature but him.
Yeah.
I mean, this woman does. You get a sense that the dead professor did.
Yep.
That other people, this Rowena, the blind woman,
mm-hmm.
Knew that. So all these,
who turns out to be his mom. Right. I mean, that's the other Oedipal thing here is about, you know, this mysterious parentage. That is, that's,
well, that's the myth of the orphan, and that's like, yeah, that is ancient, ancient myth.
Yeah, and you know, and it's so powerful. I mean, people do not get sick of that. I mean,
no, Harry Potter,
freaking Potter,
Buffy,
and Buffy
becomes her dad abandons her,
right,
and then her mother dies.
Yep, yep, so she becomes
an orphan
self.
It is, the orphan is,
yeah.
Well, you know, Jung said you do not live until you kill your parents.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, when you think about it, a lot of great works of fiction, somewhere in there, if it's not at the beginning of the book, it's supposed that some point in the history of this character, the parents were killed or dead or missing, or and then life begins.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Dickens.
Yeah, I mean, all those Dickens, you know, Pip says, you know, my parents died and I don't know, you know, and here I am, and right. This is where I begin,
right.
I am an orphan, I am going to make myself, right. And here are the things that I make myself out of,
right. I know what I was going to say, that in this book I think it is interesting that, you know, there is a talk of evil, you know, this professor sees this species as evil,
The professor does, Mondrick does, who gets exactly, I don't know, a paragraph in the entire book.
But he's talked about a lot.
But he's talked about a lot, yes. But
he's
always
the father figure that's, you know, he's the invisible father figure.
He's the invisible father figure.
But the evil, you know, there's to talk about, we have to get rid of these people, we have to expose this child of the night, we have to do all this, and that's all because they're evil. And why are they evil? They're evil because they want to live.
They want to exist. Yeah, that's what I was going to talk about. Because the evil in this book, in many horror novels, the evil is a given. You know, you say, oh, it's a demon or it's a vampire, and you see a couple of the effects of it. You know, a body torn limb from limb, or you know, something like that, or, you know, they caused the Holocaust, or they caused the Inquisition, or something like that. They see that kind of evil. But in this book, you see it from the other side. And you never, all the murders that happen, it's Will Barbie who's doing them. And you know it as he's doing them.
And you know that he's doing it. The character doesn't know that he's doing it.
Yeah, but when he's doing it, he's in his transformed state.
Right, and he's in a dream.
And he's in a dream, and he's exalting in it. And part of him is holding back, but he, you know, when he's in his transformed state, when he shifts shapes, he's free.
Right.
All you see is basically the witch folk, the lycanthropes side of the story, which is kind of gutty. You do
see it through their eyes, kind of in reverse, because you're seeing it sort of twice removed, because he's thinking, he's dreaming this, and he's killing somebody, and he shouldn't be killing this person because they're a friend, but he's being told this person is out to destroy us.
Yeah.
So you get it, it's sort of twisted around.
It's very tricky.
It's very tricky that way, but you keep hearing, once they're out of the dream and there's the antagonist or whatever you want to, and even the antagonists aren't purely antagonists. You don't really, you have sympathy for them. They have this knowledge and they're frightened that something's going to happen.
Yeah. But you never get inside their head. And I think,
yeah, you're not inside their head. And what you're told is these other things are evil. Oh, these other things are evil. And what I was going to say is, I'm thinking, and if there's something seminal about this, is that think about the vampire novels and the vampire things that have come out since then.
Well, I'm thinking
where creatures are not purely evil. They're not.
I'm thinking
look at Angel. Look at.
I'm thinking of a specific.
Even Anne Rice's stuff, God forbid.
Kind of.
You know, but they're not evil creatures. They are species that want to survive.
I'm thinking of a specific vampire novel that most reminds me of this one, where.
The Vampire Tapestries?
The Vampire Tapestries. Susie McKee Charnas's Vampire Tapestry book.
But a lot of those vampire books are like this. And you go all the way up to now with that. That is a Dornale Southern Gothic mystery vampire series where the vampires basically have come out and said, we're being discriminated against because we have this disease, and so we need to have equal rights as all the other other beings.
Yeah, this book I think is the first book to take the supernatural horror genre. The first book that I've encountered to take the supernatural horror genre, which. For the most part, that genre says, here is an evil that we all agree on. It's a fear that we all have. It's a monster that is just a monster. We see this monster. We know it's evil. No explanation needed.
What about I Was a Teenage Werewolf?
That's about puberty.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Hair starts growing in places it didn't used to before. You know, suddenly you start seeing girls and you feel these weird urges. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still waiting for that.
But this is the first one, a book that I could think of that I've encountered that sort of takes makes an attempt to scientifically explain these things, and the way Jack Williamson does it is a mixture of genetics and Stone Age anthropology and Sir George Fraser's Golden Bough sort of myth mapping, Jungian, the big story, like, you know, all these cultures have the same sort of shape of their myth, and therefore that must be some sort of basic human fact. And so in this book, the fact that they find many human cultures, their myth cycles have shapeshifters.
Well, I think what's interesting in this is that, you know, take as opposed to the vampire, let's say, which needs to, you know, it's a predator that needs to have feed on human blood. This species and president of this book don't need humans in order to exist. You know, they don't need to feed on human flesh. They don't need to drink their blood.
But
they're a threat only because they exist.
Yeah.
And that they're different.
Well, but actually, near the end of the book, they do explain that that they acquired a taste for human blood, for human flesh, during the ice ages when the species were separated and they developed different.
Right, but as they're presented now, they don't really.
Yeah.
Their killing isn't
no.
out of no. I'm hungry and need to eat. It's out of you're going to kill us.
Yeah.
So we've got to act now.
So as a horror novel, was there any horror in this novel?
Well, you know, it's
that's a big can of worms.
I was really thinking like, what does that even mean?
What does horror even mean?
Was if meaning was I scared?
Yeah. Well, say were you scared? Books don't scare me ever.
I've had books that have scared me.
Really?
Yeah.
I've got a little chill, where I sit and think about something.
Like I said in the last Conjure. Lady Darkness.
Our Lady of Darkness.
Yeah, I was, you know, where you kind of jump out of your skin.
There was a scene.
It was that visceral thing. I did not feel that.
The next book, and we're going to get to this very soon, I think. About talking about the next book, but we have to pick one that we think is going to scare us. I think we're going to have to get something in mind.
Well, and I think being scared is different than being grossed out.
True.
Right. So I think, but no, did this book scare me? No. Maybe the only way it would scare me is in sort of an academic sort of perspective of. Wow, when human beings don't understand something, or when something's other than human beings just flip.
Yeah.
And think about when this book was written, you know, we're talking about the beginning of the Red Scare.
Yep.
We're talking about Nazism.
Yep.
We're talking about, you know, that's the context. So the other is always a frightening thing. I mean, that goes through history. So Even in this, the other is to be automatically a threat.
Yeah. This book, I think this book is explanatory. It's an attempt to very cleverly explain away
our bad selves.
Well, an entire other genre. It's like, I'm going to write a science fiction book that explains all of supernatural horror. And because they talk about werewolves, they talk about vampires, because at the end she says, you have now become a vampire.
Right.
You're dead, but you're still here. You are now immortal.
Right. And witchcraft.
And witchcraft. She's a witch because she has these powers.
And they all are. I mean, the one creature is three. One person is three creatures. Human and...
Human, witch, like and werewolf.
Human, witch, werewolf.
Yeah. And if they'd stitched somebody together and had him...
And ghost. He's kind of a ghost, too.
He's kind of a ghost, too. So if they stitched somebody together and had him walk around, they would have all the universal monsters. Oh, and mummies. Wait a minute.
What about Abbott and Costello?
Abbott and Costello do not appear.
Meet the mummy / vampire / werewolf /
What did you think of the ending? Be the very like last page. Do you remember the little trick he does at the end? He's deciding whether or not to kill.
He followed her into the shadows.
Well, no, he decides he's in his he's in his were pterodactyl form. No, were pteranodon form. And she says the finally the mysterious contents of the green box are destroyed. It's may or may not be a chunk of uranium or something like that.
Some kind of instrument, some kind of disc or something.
Yeah. And it falls away from him. And she says, go down and finish him off now. And he says, no, I'm not going to do that. And then there's this little bit about where he speculates that, he could go away and instead of, sort of telling his story on the radio as true, he could write it all down as a novel and have it published and have it people sort of just slightly believe it and just sort of kind of slowly be aware of the possibility.
Obviously it didn't stick with me that much because I did not remember.
Yeah, well, I finished this book seconds before we started this podcast. I thought it was clever, but now I think it's kind of cheap.
It's cheesy. I don't know.
It could have been worse. It could have been one of those things where, oh, they're breaking down the door now, and oh no, my God, here it comes! Arrgh! And the line goes down across the page. You'd be surprised at how many pre 20th century horror novels end that way.
It was, the ending was. I just like that he picked up her exciting scent and followed her into the shadows.
Oh yeah, well,
because you know those bloody
because they have to
wear women.
They have to mate
in their scents.
Yeah, they have to mate because they have to produce offspring. More genetically pure, lycanthrope people offspring. I don't know. I mean, I enjoy reading this book quite a bit. As a piece of historical fiction. not historical fiction, a historical piece of fiction. It is very much part of its time. I love that. I mean,
it was a part of its time, but it also felt modern. I mean, in a strange way, there was a modern sort of the sexuality seemed modern to me. Mm-hmm.
My favorite kind of books that are like period pieces are the ones that are written in the period and are trying to be ultra modern. And so in this one,
this has a Rat Pack written all over.
It's sort of pre Rat Pack actually. Yeah. It was but it's hard boiled. So this Jack Williamson had clearly been reading his Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, because the way he's knocking back, he's this hard bitten this newspaper reporter.
But his best name was Barbie. It's hard to take him seriously.
Flack from no dames, and he's.
But he was really disturbed by the dead kitten.
How
hard boiled can you be?
Well, dead kittens are
poor Fluffy.
Well, yeah, I think he was mostly disturbed by the dead kitten because of who killed it. Which was this entirely enchanting dame.
You know what I wanted to mention is I did like in this book about the way the murders take place is through the probability.
Yes.
Like, it's that...
probability manipulation.
Right. And that, in a way, it's not a direct murder as so much as... which is sort of the idea of witchcraft, which is that you bend the will of things.
Yeah.
And well, so there's something already there, and you're sort of...
you're just looking for the opportunity. You're
blowing on it, or you're looking for like a little kink in the wax to sort of bend it another way.
It's Uri Geller
bending the spoons.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting...
Well, the whole thing about the mind web...
Yes.
Well, that is current again. I keep using this term memes, and that, you know, I haven't done a lot of reading on this, but, you know, it shows up in various sci-fi books and things like that about distributed knowledge, about considering various brains as if they were individual cells of a much larger brain that are communicating not through electrochemical, but through...
Action and technology and language and
things like that. And that larger consciousness of which we are all a part is thinking and making decisions and affecting things.
Right. That's what I was reading in the book on that book of 2005 Things Not to Read or something.
What's that?
The 2005 best of 2005.
Best 2005 non-essential reading.
Right. And they were interviewing a physicist or something, saying, what is something that you believe but can't prove right now?
Oh, I've seen this list.
And that was, that dude said that same thing, is that we are all, our brains are all connected through our activity. You know, it is standing farther and farther back. It is one organism.
Yeah. Yeah. That we are Gaia thinking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Which is kind of cool. I mean, that's a science fiction, which makes so much sense. That's a science fiction trope that goes way back, and this is the first one that I've seen. But I think of that goofy, like, must have been first season Star Trek episode about the. They go to that planet and it's been overtaken by giant brain cells.
Yeah,
which is kind of silly, but it's just your giant brain thinking.
Yeah,
and using
humanity is one. Well, that's the whole collective unconscious. We're all one underneath.
Yeah,
this it's on the subatomic level. It's another, all one unit.
Another recent version of it is a couple of best-selling science fiction novels by Greg Bear called Darwin's Radio. Which uses a modern virus theory that viruses are, that they become part of the genetic code.
Right.
And that viruses are
ways. Are what makes mutation.
Are ways that species as a species think and decide. And when viruses decide that the species needs to change, the species changes.
When viruses go wild. Viruses gone.
Which is kind of interesting. I mean, I could barely, because I'm not, a, I'm, I don't do science.
Show us your nucleus.
Hey, baby. Nice dendrites. Is that your axon, or are you just happy to see me? Oh, Lord. I don't do science, but clearly I remember the parts of it.
Cells anatomy.
Of a neuron. This is an interesting book. I mean,
I couldn't get excited about this book.
No,
I can't even be funny about it.
I think we need the next book.
We need something more rip roaring.
Are we ready to go on to the next one? Are we ready to finish up with this book?
Yes.
We recommend Darker Than You Think. It is in print, and
I recommend it just because I think it's a foundational book.
It's a foundational book, and it's interesting. I mean, it's a period piece, so is The Telltale Heart, for God's sake.
Absolutely.
So, but for our next book, I think we need something rip roaring. We need something that is either going to scare us or is going to gross us out. Or at least be excited. Right,
so what are you thinking?
Something brand new.
All right.
I don't know what. I don't know what. I'm thinking. Here's what I'm thinking. I think we should go to a bookstore, and we should pull a book off the shelf, a new book, in mass market paperback. I'm thinking something by Brian Keene or Joe Lansdale.
What about those ones that I was talking about, those zombies who are...
I'm ready for a zombie
Death movie City again. Or something. Or...
Monster Island? Isn't it? Monster, is it... There's a couple.
Well, here's what we'll do. We will post the next book on the website.
Be, it'll be on the website. You'll see. It'll be the book on the table.
And we will then we'll read the book and discuss the book.
We'll read it up, talk it down. Or
and hopefully read it down I'll be and a little more a little drunker than I am right now.
I know. This is a
week. We can never do this after work again.
Yeah, I know. We're recording this on a Wednesday night.
Wednesday is not hump day is not the time to record.
It is not the time. We need to do this on a Saturday night when tomorrow is nothing but Sunday. All recovery, no net.
Well, then okay. So let's put a stake in this puppy
and cut off its head.
Put some garlic down its throat.
And call it an end.
All right.
Zombie guards, seize him!
Tell me that's not fun to say. Yeah.